Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. James Backus, our guest for today, says that the path to global sustainable development is participatory democratic global governance. It's the only truly effective path, he says, to confronting pandemics, military conflict, climate change, biodiversity loss, and potential overall ecological collapse. In his book, Democracy for a Sustainable World, he explains why global democracy and global sustainable development must be achieved and why they can only be achieved jointly. As he recounts the obstacles to participatory democratic global governance and describes how they can be overcome. James Backus is a distinguished university professor of global affairs and director of the Center for Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity at the University of Central Florida. He was a founding judge and twice the chairman, the chief judge of the highest tribunal of the world trade, the appellate body of World Trade Organization. He's a former member of Congress of the United States from Florida. And his previous books include The Willing World and Trade Links, which are both listed as best books by the Financial Times. James Backus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me. And I'm pleased to say that my new book, Democracy for a Sustainable World, has just been named one of the best books of the summer by the Financial Times. I'm, of course, very pleased and gratified about that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, that's great. So interesting, a lot to talk about here. But I want to take you back, as you do in your acknowledgments, just it's kind of a preface to this conversation. You say the idea, thought of writing this book came about a decade ago, reading from the acknowledgments. As you looked out on the Acropolis and the teeming metropolis of modern Athens from the peaceful hillside of the Pnyx. Is that how you pronounce it?
Pnyx.
Yeah,
P-N-Y-X for your listeners.
Yes.
Yes, that's true. The Pnyx is the hillside where a renegade aristocrat named Cleisthenes and a lot of ordinary Athenians invented what we can recognize millennia later as the first real democracy. In Athens, in ancient Greece, it is about a quarter of a mile from the Acropolis. I went there in 2014 as a pilgrimage and was surprised to see that I was virtually the only one there. Meanwhile, a quarter of a mile away, the Acropolis was filled to overflowing with tourists. The Pnyx is one of the most important places in the world, but it's largely been overlooked as a tourist site, yet a lot happened there. And it was when I first visited the Pnyx that I asked myself, what really happened here, and did anything that happened here occur in such a way that it might be helpful to us today and trying to find a way to make more democracy and make democracy more successful at a time when we desperately need it. And that was the genesis of this book.
Previously, you've written on international trade, international law, the international political economy. And you say in the book that this is kind of a natural progression, now linking democracy with sustainable development.
That's correct. This is the first time I've written about democracy. Of course, I practiced democracy all my long life. Along the way, I've been privileged to serve in legislative, judicial, and administrative roles at every level of governance, from the local to the global. So I have that experience. But my previous books have been about those other issues. And I asked myself, do I have something to say about democracy that hasn't been said before? It turns out that this book is the first book that's been written about the relationship between democracy and sustainable development. And also, although quite a few books written by political theorists have suggested we need somehow to create democratic global governance, I may be the first one actually to set out some specific proposals for achieving it.
So you say you believe that democracy and sustainable development are inextricably linked. We cannot achieve one without achieving the other. So before we get into that very interesting premise, define for us sustainable development. That includes quite a bit.
Most people think of sustainability as just relating to the environment. It certainly relates to the environment. But sustainability and sustainable development are not solely about the environment. They're about our goals environmentally, economically, and socially for achieving full human flourishing and protecting our imperiled planet. The United Nations, a decade ago, and I was one of many people who participated in this, concluded the sustainable development goals. The first one is to eliminate poverty. Another is to eliminate hunger. The third is to create gender equity. Another is to provide health care for everyone. There are many goals that don't relate to the environment, although, of course, there are environmental goals relating to addressing climate change, protecting us against the degradation of our species and our land and our water. But the point of the Sustainable Development Goals and the idea underlying sustainable development is that all of these things are inextricably interlinked and can only be achieved if we achieve them, in the words of the SDGs, as they're called, holistically. If we achieve them by working to achieve all of them together. This is what the world has been doing with some success, but not enough, over the past decade. My point is this about the relationship between a democracy and sustainable development. Human development can be achieved through achieving the social, economic, and environmental goals of sustainable development improves our ability to govern ourselves. It makes us capable of making democracy work. At the same time, and in addition, with respect to democracy itself, it's the practice of democracy true democracy, genuine democracy, participatory democracy, that alone, I believe, can help us achieve the human flourishing and the planetary protection of sustainable development.
So I want to explore that a little further. Have we not made progress worldwide by a kind of a mix of democratic governments, authoritarian governments? But you know, if an authoritarian government has if the leader has the inclination to try to solve some of these problems, could that not work, at least a mix?
No. Authoritarian governance is always there if we do not live up to the promise of democracy. The authoritarian temptation is always there. It's here now. There's always the temptation to look to some strong man or some one leader or some Politburo to make our decisions for us. But there's an abundance of empirical evidence that when democracy truly exists, it is much more successful in improving human flourishing than any authoritarian rule. The notion that China is somehow, because it's authoritarian, more capable of providing for its people is nonsense. And I say this as someone who first went to China in 1979 and has been there many, many times through the decades. And the notion that we can abandon our democracy here in the United States and entrust governance to one man, whoever that man may be, and somehow help ourselves is a foolish fantasy. What's needed is democratic governance. All the problems in the world, whether they're climate change, biodiversity loss, job security, whatever it may be, Our problems of governance, the reason why we haven't been able to address them is because we haven't figured out how best to govern ourselves. The democracies we have are really only, for the most part, half democracies or pretend democracies. Some of our best democracies are slipping away from democracy. The problem of governance is a lack of trust. People, in fact, for many good reasons, distrust elites. They distrust governments. They distrust the wealthy. They distrust institutions. They especially distrust international institutions. What is the remedy for this? The remedy is participation. I think we will be able to have trust and restore trust only if people are permitted to truly govern themselves. And I've made some proposals for how we could do that. They may seem radical to some, but to me, they're not radical at all. To me, the logical end conclusion of democracy is doing everything possible to help achieve the core promise of democracy that was set out in ancient Athens on the Pnyx, and that is self-rule. And that's why I propose that we reform the structures of governments all over the world at every level of governance to vastly increase participation in governance by ordinary people.
I want to get into your ideas, specific ideas, practical ideas here. But one more kind of definitional thing, because it's brought up a lot. Our own Senator Mike Lee here stresses that the United States is not a democracy, and that the representative form of Republican government, right? The representation is still there, right? But I wonder if the stressing representative Republican form of government maybe lessens full participation in your mind. How do you parse that out?
Senator Lee has a point, up to a point. Our country was founded as a democratic republic with the emphasis initially on republic. Why was that so? Because there was apprehension among the founders of our country that because of the size of the 13 colonies, direct democracy through direct participation by the people was not feasible. So they chose instead to have representation. But within just a few decades, into the 1820s and 1830s, we began to expand the electorate so that we became much more democratic. The problem today with our system of representation is, frankly, that it's not representative. And I don't propose abolishing it. I propose improving it. And I set out quite a few ideas for doing so in the book. I believe we need to create right representation, which is based not on special interest, not on money, not on partisan political politicking, but on merit. And if we have right representation, we then have the best of individual wisdom, which I would suggest we do not have now, unfortunately, where I previously served in the Congress of the United States. In addition, I believe we need to summon the best of collective wisdom from the people. And there, I believe we should emulate the ancient Athenians by using sortition. Now, there were problems with the Athenian democracy, I want to hasten to say. Women were not included. Immigrants were not included. There were tens of thousands of slaves in ancient Athens, enslaved people. This shocks the modern conscience. But if we look beyond that to the quality of democracy that those minority who were citizens had through their direct participation, we can see that there's much there that we can learn from and emulate. Furthermore, we have an advantage over the founders of the United States and over the ancient Athenians in that here today we know a lot much more about mathematics. We understand the rules of probability. We understand scientific sampling. So we can engage, if we choose, in sortition, in random selection, in a way in which those who are randomly selected from among volunteers will accurately reflect the diversity of the composition of a population, whatever that size of the population may be, including the 330 million people of the United States of America.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to follow up on this, your idea of sortition, which comes from ancient Greece, right? The birthplace of democracy. We're talking with James Backus, a distinguished university professor of global affairs, director of the Center for Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity, University of Central Florida. Author most recently of the interesting book, Democracy for a Sustainable World. That's what we're talking about on the program today. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with James Backus. He is author of several books. He's also distinguished university professor of global affairs, director of Center for Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity at the University of Central Florida. He's a former member of the United States Congress, former official of the appeals system of the World Trade Organization, a whole lot in his biography. And he's written on previously on trade and sustainable development. Now he links it to democracy. In fact, in this book, he says that global democracy and global sustainable development can only be achieved jointly. And he takes us back to the Pnyx, that hill in Athens where democracy was born. I just want to, as a preface here to getting into some of these particulars, James Backus, I want to read this from you. He says, ancient Athenian democratic experiment teaches us that real democracy, real self-rule, requires full participation by all citizens. And of course, even in what we call democracies, United States here, we don't have full participation. So take us back to Athens at that point, the Pnyx, and tell us how they did it.
Well, there was an Athenian assembly. All citizens were able to participate in this assembly, which met many times every year on the Pnyx. And they were all equal within that assembly in being able to speak and decide. In addition to that, the administrative task of the Athenian citizenry were done on the basis of random selection among volunteers, among the citizens. All the dozens and dozens of usually 10-member administrative boards that ran Athens on a day-to-day basis, weights and measures, transportation, food supply, water supply, and so much more, were chosen by random selection from citizen volunteers. And furthermore, they rotated once a year. The classical experts on ancient Athens tell us that perhaps as many as a third or more of all the citizens of Athens at some time in their lives, once, maybe even twice, which was the maximum, served on one of these executive boards of Athens. In addition, much of what happened in Athens was done through jury courts that decided legal disputes, just as we do. In fact, our jury selection process is more or less inherited from the ancient Athenians through our mother country of England. And there were through random selection, several thousand people who were chosen every year to be potential jurors. And they, too, were selected randomly, and they made the legal decisions for Athens. The system evolved over time, over 200 years. It's important to point out that the Athenian democracy as a process and as an institution did not fail. The Athenians, in the end, were conquered by the Macedonians, by Philip of Macedon and his son, who later became Alexander the Great. So they suffered military defeat. They did not suffer the collapse of their democracy because it wasn't working. And it improved over time with checks and balances, not too dissimilar to some that we have and I hope we keep. But on a day-to-day basis, they had a system that worked. And it worked very effectively because they had this system. They had a much more open society. And this open society was much more innovative. It was much more outreaching in terms of trade to the rest of the Mediterranean and up into the Black Sea. And Athens not only had self-governance that other city-states in Greece did not have, but it had a prosperity that they did not have. And this, I think, can be traced to the democracy itself and the success of their democracy. Of course, they had their defeats along the way, including the Peloponnesian War. But even there, they learned from that defeat. And in their second century, the Athenians were much more democratic than they were in the first.
So they made adjustments as they went along, right? But tell me about this idea of sortition maybe a bit of an analog in our system that we inherited, as you said, from Athens through England is the jury duty, right? You're randomly selected. Is that what you're suggesting, that we adopt that from ancient Greece?
Yes. What we would have, and I suggest we do this locally, at the state and provincial level, at the national level, and in all of our international institutions, we should select decision-making bodies by random selection. And then I would have the right representatives we previously discussed provide the best of individual wisdom, and the ordinary people chosen by random selection through sortition to provide the best of collective wisdom. And together, I think we could have the best decisions. And if ordinary people are participating in the process, I think they're much more likely to trust it. At the global level, I propose that we have what I call circles of participation, randomly selected worldwide from volunteers, numbering millions upon millions upon millions and increasing millions over time, in every single international institution, starting with the United Nations, including all the specialized institutions of the United Nations. In addition, the governing bodies of other international institutions, international treaties, international arrangements of all kind. And I believe these circles of participation should be given equal decision-making authority with the existing decision-making bodies in that institution, such as the current General Assembly of the United Nations. Furthermore, I believe we need, on an advisory basis, two additional kinds of randomly selected circles in each and every one of these institutions. One would be a circle for the future point out the need to provide what those of us who focus on sustainable development called intergenerational equity. Sustainable development means doing what we need to do now without damaging the ability of those who follow us to do what they need to do in providing for a good life. And that's called intergenerational equity. And I would have volunteers aged 12 to 21 from worldwide random selection serve on these circles of the future. If you don't think young people can be concerned about the future, and especially environmentally, then you're not paying attention out there because young people are doing that every day. Lastly, in addition, I would have Circles for Nature. One of the biggest problems we have is our increasing separation from nature. There was a study came out just last week, reported in The Guardian, so I don't mention it in the book, showing that our individual connection with nature worldwide is about 60% less than it was just a generation ago. We are increasingly separated from nature, and yet we're a part of nature. Our economy, for example, is not separate and apart from the environment. The economy exists within the environment. And it's only if we become naturized, and believe me, I was surprised to find that actually is a word, it's only if we become fully aware that we are a part of nature, that we are animals who have a kinship to other species and to all on the planet, and that we're all traveling together on this small blue dot called Earth in the universe, that we're going to be able to solve our problems. And by that, I don't just mean our environmental problems. I mean the other problems of sustainable development, the social and economic problems of sustainable development. We cannot even talk about an economic future without reference, for example, to climate change and biodiversity loss and other ways in which we're pushing up against the planetary boundaries of the world.
So I can see some attractive features here, right? Our listeners probably can as well to this, get more people involved. But use the word volunteer. Would people put their hat in the ring, or would this be just a random selection from everybody in the community?
It would be random selection from among volunteers, okay. Just as was done in ancient Athens. In ancient Athens, people who didn't volunteer were frowned upon, and almost everyone did, but they allowed what political scientists call free riders, people to benefit from the system even if they did not participate actively in human action to make it work. I think we should do the same, and I think that we can, especially over time, accumulate vast numbers of volunteers worldwide and in local communities who will be willing to take part in this process. Looking back to the development, for example, of the Sustainable Development Goals themselves, the United Nations, to its credit, involved an estimated 5 million people worldwide in putting the goals together. Now, we need a lot more than 5 million people worldwide, and yet we have the means to achieve it, as I have explained before. What matters with random sampling, what matters with scientific approaches to sortition is the size of the sample and the accuracy of the sample in reflecting the randomness of the population. It's not the size of the population. So just as we can have a sample pool and ultimately a sortition circle that would represent 330 million Americans, so too we could have one that would represent 8.2 billion people worldwide. And at the global level, it's my very strong view that what we need to be doing is beginning to be acting together as one humanity. And we're moving in the opposite direction now. As an example, when I was in the Congress 30 years ago, I represented Central Florida, including the Kennedy Space Center. I was much involved in as an advocate for our space program. And I was one of the principal sponsors for the space station, which is up in the sky now, at least for a while longer, and has been there for a quarter of a century, providing a great deal of scientific and other benefits to us. At the time, we decided to make the space station international and invited a number of other countries to join us. We sold that in the Congress as a fiscal measure. It would cost us less. But actually, those of us who sold it as a fiscal measure were actually doing it for more idealistic reasons, in addition to the fiscal reasons. We believed, and I continue to strongly believe, that humanity ought to go together into space as one species, as humanity. And I think we need to do that today, and I think we also need to address our problems here on Earth in the same way. A lot of the problems we face, such as climate change, cannot be solved unless we cooperate together as humanity. And we're not doing that now. Why are we not doing that? Largely because back home in democracies and elsewhere in non-democracies, people, for the most part, don't trust the changes that have to be made in order to deal with these ecological challenges. They don't trust these changes because they don't trust the people who are deciding about these changes. They don't trust these so-called elites. And the remedy, as I've said, is to restore trust, and I think the only way to do that is by allowing people to participate. It's by taking democracy seriously. And if we take democracy seriously, it means that we have to fulfill that commitment that was made initially by the Athenians and has been made also in the United States through the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution to genuine self-rule. We have to keep that promise. We've been moving closer to it for generations in the United States. Other countries have been doing the same along the way, moving, for example, toward universal suffrage. It took us a few decades to do it. It took the British more than a century to do it. Others took longer. But that's not enough. If the right representation, even if it is right, is not enough. Because we need, in addition to the best of individual wisdom, in my view, also the best of collective wisdom. Because the people together can be smarter than they are individually. This, by the way, is not my original thought. This is the thought, originally, of Aristotle, who, by the way, was an immigrant in Athens. And because he was an immigrant, he could not be a citizen.
So we're, I guess, immigrants, women, others, slaves, for example, they could not volunteer to be part of this sortition, I guess.
They could not. They were not citizens. This was, of course, wrong. And as I said earlier, it shocks our modern sensibilities, and rightly so. I was taught in graduate school by a famous Yale professor named C. Ben Woodward, one of the great American historians. He taught me that what we need to do in looking at the past is not to look just at where people were at the time, but to look rather at where they were going. And the Athenians were going on a path they set out on the Pnyx, and that path was participation. And because they did not fulfill the full implications of their original ideas is not a reason why we shouldn't value what they did. The same is true of the founders of the United States, many of them slaveholders. Someone such as Thomas Jefferson, for example, who was a slaveholder, he could not personally fulfill the full implications of the ideas that he so eloquently set out in the Declaration of Independence, that all of us are created equal. But we can continue now to move toward fulfilling those ideas, and the only way to do so, I think, is by improving participation. If we don't improve participation, if we don't vastly enhance it, I don't think we'll be able to have the trust we need to make government work in what currently pass for democracies. We need a much fuller democracy. We need what John Dewey called a living democracy. And a living democracy is one in which, as he said, democracy is a way of life. It's one in which we participate. You may say this will be hard to achieve, but as I point out at length in the book, it's being achieved now in many, many ways that are not getting any attention from the media of any kind. And that is, we have thousands upon thousands of thousands in the United States and throughout the world of voluntary local and regional sustainable development networks of people who have come together to fight poverty, to improve education, to improve health solutions, to achieve gender equity, to address environmental problems, to do away with poison water, to prevent hunger. Most of these groups have not submitted their names to the United Nations, although about 50,000 have worldwide. But there are many, many thousands more, and each and every one of them in the world, wherever they may be, is an experiment in democratic participation. These are positive actions that we are overlooking now. And what I suggest is that we build on this by linking these groups up, by scaling them up, by creating de facto in the world, outside of government, true participation through sortition. These groups can pioneer in doing this. Already we're starting to do some of this at the global level. 4 years ago, in Glasgow, at the climate conference there, COP26, there was a global citizens assembly organized on the sidelines of the conference by means of sortition worldwide. This coming November in Brazil, there will be a second one that is going to draw much more widely on the global population in its sortition, and it will be an actual part of the conference. Amazingly, the government of Brazil has been very supportive of this. Overall, I do not expect governments to leap forward to begin to make these kinds of changes, but I believe that over time, ordinary people, by working together, by believing that tomorrow can be better than today, by trusting each other and trusting their ability to rule themselves at every level, can begin to surround governments to the point where they will have to respond at every level of governance, from the local to the global.
Let's take another break, come back with the final segment with James Backus. We're talking about his new book, Democracy for a Sustainable World. And we'll have more on this following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking with James Backus. He is a distinguished university professor of global affairs and director of the Center for Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity at the University of Central Florida. Has a long history in many areas, including he was founding judge, twice chairman, chief judge of the highest tribunal of world trade, the appellate body of World Trade Organization. He's a former member of Congress of the United States from Florida, author of several books, including The Willing World and The Trade Links. Now, his new book, Democracy for a Sustainable World. He says that global democracy and global sustainable development can only be achieved jointly. So I want to ask you a question you pose in the book here. At the end of your book, you say it may well be asked, what Pollyanna pie-in-the-sky suggestion for democratic global governance is this that has been set out here? So I'll just pose that to you. You really believe this can be achieved?
Absolutely. All my life, I've worked for causes when initially I and those who worked alongside me were told we had no chance of success. And I've, together with many others, overcome the obstacles and made a success of the cause. I mentioned the space station earlier. I announced in December of 1993 that I would not seek a third term in the Congress. I did that in part because I wanted to focus on weighing the space station vote the following year. At the time I made that decision, we were, by our count, 110 votes short of winning, and we were told that there was no way we could win by many people who ended up voting for the space station. And in the end, we won by one vote in the House of Representatives. But that was just as good as winning by 100 votes, and the space station is still up there in the sky. When I was a trade negotiator for the United States in the late 70s, a number of us set out to remedy the failure of countries following World War II to create an international trade organization. We were told that we never could succeed. 16 years later, we created the World Trade Organization. Now, hard things are always hard. The only way to try to achieve a hard thing is to start trying. As I've stressed earlier, we have to try together. So people who want to try have to work together. What matters is human action. I think ideas are important, and I think process is important, but we're not going to be able to implement our ideas or have the right processes unless we act. I am undeterred by those who might say this is unachievable. I've heard that before, and the truth of the matter is that around the world there are quite a few experiments now that are being held with citizens' assemblies, citizen juries, and the like. All this can be linked up. If we link up the people who are working for more participatory democracy with those who are working worldwide for sustainable development, then that will be a mighty global force, and ultimately one that I believe will be irresistible. Am I an optimistic person? Absolutely. Am I idealistic? Of course. But I'm a practical idealist, and I believe we have a duty of optimism. I have been involved in trying to make democracy work since I was a teenager and volunteered in my first political campaign when I was in the eighth grade. That's a long time ago. And all of my experience through the years tells me that this is the only way we can work our way through our current dilemma, with is confronting us with so many doubts and disappointments on so many fronts worldwide. We have to believe in ourselves, and we have to believe in democracy. If we believe in democracy, then we believe in true self-rule. Then we believe that people can actually govern themselves, and we must give them an opportunity to do so. Otherwise, we're not truly Democrats.
I want to talk about the stakes. You write, I'll read from James Baucus here. You say we must create and recreate public trust, and this can only be done through creation of more democratic participation. You go on to say, without much broader and deeper popular support, the necessary new ways of shaping how we live within the world cannot be created. And then you lay out a couple of scenarios if we don't try new things, right? Either decisions will not be made, as you say, seems to be the path we're trying right now, or decisions will eventually be made not democratically but by coercion. So under here, just a couple of minutes left, talk about the stakes if we don't try some new things, as you're suggesting.
Simply ignoring the challenges we're facing in the world ecologically, for example, is not going to make them go away. Climate change is real, it's here, it's accelerating. Biodiversity loss with all its implications for humanity is real, it's here, and it's accelerating. These things are happening. Ignoring them won't stop these things from happening. And eventually, we could be in a position where will suffer the not just from a general authoritarian temptation, but from what might be called green authoritarianism. A lot of people in government will decide, well, this has to be done. We have to restrict the freedoms of people in order to preserve society. That's not the path we want to take. We want to take the path of participation, the path from the Panix. That's what I propose. Because if we get the process right, if we have true democracy, then we can come together and we can make decisions together in a way that will engender trust and thus will help us not only make decisions, but to make those decisions work democratically.
Just a couple minutes here. Maybe at the end here, talk a little bit about, you know, irrespective of these creative ideas that you have here and you'd hope are implemented, but just this idea of full participation in democracy. Maybe we can encourage fellow citizens. You say in the book that participation in democracy is not just voting every once in a while, right? I think we have a vague idea. Yeah, that's true, but a lot of us don't go beyond that. Some of us don't even get there. A lot of us don't even go beyond that. So I guess there are a lot of ways to more fully participate in democracy.
Of course there are. And most of them don't involve doing anything in government or relating to government. If you volunteer to deliver Meals on Wheels or to work at a museum or do something related to helping disadvantaged children, that's democratic participation. What I'm suggesting to people is that they not retreat into their private lives entirely, but rather go in the other direction, participate with the other people in doing things that matter to our civilization in a way that will help preserve and advance civilization at every level. And I think if people do this, they will find that their lives are richer and more fulfilling. And they will be able then better to achieve the highest hopes that they have.
Well, good place to end the conversation. We're out of time. We've been talking with James Backus. The new book is out and available now, Democracy for a Sustainable World. And James Backus is Distinguished University Professor of Global Affairs and Director of the Center for Global Economic and Environmental Opportunity at University of Central Florida. James Backus, thank you so much. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thanks to all your listeners. I very much appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, and thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
This is Wild About Utah.
Birds foster community connections. I don't know why, but birds possess a special power to connect diverse communities. You see, birds don't discriminate. They don't care who you are, what you look like, where you live, or what you believe. They're always there to offer you their wonder, beauty, and interesting behaviors, so long as you're willing to be aware and curious of their presence. And that awareness seems to bring people and places together. 3 years ago, when I first became interested in using Utah birds as a core theme for teaching my second graders at Utah State University's Edith Bowen Laboratory School, I had no idea how it would revolutionize my teaching career and connect me and my students with so many different natural and human communities. Personally, I formed connections with people and places I would have never expected, such as the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, Bridgerland Audubon Society, this Utah Public Radio community, various natural resource professors at USU, untold numbers of new, beautiful outdoor locations around the state, and even various important state educational stakeholders. But beyond me, I'm most excited to see how an increased awareness of Utah birds has led to my students making connections in their own lives. My students are starting to experience Utah's nature community in a new and more powerful way. The main way? by becoming aware. I can't emphasize enough the power I've seen in my students just becoming aware of the natural world around them. Their simple everyday routines become opportunities to notice something going on around them in nature. Something as routine as school recess can turn into an opportunity to notice interesting natural phenomena. For example, when a student noticed a European starling had borne through the school siding, created a nest, and had been returning over and over to feed her impatient, chirping chicks. Or when a hen mallard had mistakenly laid her eggs in a nest next to the school's air conditioning unit. Or when students found a dead black-capped chickadee who must have unfortunately collided with a school window. Furthermore, my students leave class and become ambassadors for learning outside of the school walls. They make connections to learning at home and get involved in their local communities in new ways. I've had countless students convince their families to get outside and explore a new local nature area in search of birds. I've had students who took their siblings on a birding outing right from their house to a nearby nature area to explore new birds. And I've had students who convinced their family they just had to go to Salt Lake City's Tracy Aviary over spring break. These examples epitomize how birds bridge connections between students' home and school knowledge, bridge connections between my students and other people in their lives, and bridge connections between my students' own lives and the natural environment around them. This is Dr. Joseph Kozlowski, and I am wild about outdoor education in Utah.